Good afternoon, everybody. School Plots are coming at you live from my house here in Cincinnati. Welcome aboard to our weekly book club class. We're doing The Return to Zion, Addresses on Religious Zionism and American Orthodoxy by the late, great Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik of Yeshiva University. Let's get back into it. He's speaking about recognition of the present and vision for the future. If you have the book, we're on page 72. And we're going to, God willing, finish this little chapter, this address, this lecture today. We won't go further than that because I like to start, the way I like to do it is, you know, you complete something and then the week after that you start something afresh. I just think it's easier for the listeners if they want to come in to a lecture, they hear it from the very top as opposed to having to slog through other material till they get to the lecture that they want to hear. So let's do it like that. We're on page 72 and God willing, we're going to get to page 80. So it's not that much material. And if it means that it's a shorter class, then it's a shorter class. Don't worry about it. Let's get right to it. I'll start in the middle of the page. And so here we go. Talking about the pallbearers of Joseph, the tzaddik, the righteous one, son of Jacob. Joseph's pallbearers think that we need to heal the aggressor. By contrast, the Mishaels and the Elzaphans maintain that the victim must disappear by committing suicide. Let not this matter be trivial in your eyes. These two attitudes dominate contemporary Jewish modes of thinking. And he was saying that the Mishaels and the Elzaphans are more dangerous than Joseph's pallbearers because the Joseph's pallbearers are only a thin stratum, a small group of wealthy Jewish aristocrats, okay, who are positioned close to the authorities. And in their short-sightedness, they think that the Josephinian era is still alive and well. The Jewish masses don't agree. They know intuitively that the Golden Age is dead and that the exile, even in Goshen, is a fact that cannot be denied. They're afraid of their own shadows. They don't believe, as do Joseph's pallbearers, that anti-Semitism can be cured scientifically by earmarking $500,000 to hire a German Jewish psychologist like Max Horkheimer, who presumably could not excise the anti-Semitic cancer in Germany, but who will, so he says, heal Jew hatred here. Today's masses are inclined to adopt the second extreme solution. Joseph's pallbearers think that we need to heal the aggressor. By contrast, the Mishaels and the Elzaphans maintain that the victim must disappear. That means, of course, us, we're the Jews, we're the victim of anti-Semitism, and we got to disappear by committing suicide. And that will get rid of anti-Semitism. With no more Jews, there's nobody to hate. Let not this matter be trivial in your eyes, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. These two attitudes dominate contemporary Jewish modes of thinking. On Thursday evening, Rabbi Judah Leib Fishman spoke correctly of the servile conduct of certain Zionist leaders and demanded a more militant posture. Yes, it is true. We must adopt a more aggressive approach. But the question is, whether American Zionists have it in them. Simply put, taking a submissive versus a militant approach is not only a matter of making a political decision at a conference via majority vote, but also it's a question of emotion. If I feel the need, the burning necessity, the powerful, irrepressible wish, if my entire soul is dominated by a single dream and vision, then I cry out, then I insist, then I demand, then I am not deferential, then I am not servile. Then the opposing side knows that here stands a bitter adversary, fully determined to whom he must surrender. In general, the world respects true tenacity and resolve. When a person's soul is completely shot through with one conviction and one idea. There is so much truth in that. When you come at the world and you represent, I am not giving up. You will yield to me. I will not yield to you. Just letting you know, one of us is going to win, and it's going to be me. The Zionists had to put that forward to the world. When you're so filled with this burning necessity, a powerful, irrepressible wish, when your whole soul is dominated by a single dream and vision, then you're letting your adversaries know they're up against a wall that is impregnable. They won't even, shouldn't even bother to attack it. In general, the world respects true tenacity and resolve. When a person's soul is completely shot through with one conviction and one idea. So right. Are there such fanatical, enthusiastic Zionists in this country? Do not point to the Mizrahi or to a couple of Zionist leaders whom I do not know. I'm asking about the rank and file of the Jewish masses, especially about the so-called younger generation. You have it all here. A Zionist party that has, so it says, doubled its membership. Remember, he's speaking in 1945. Hadassah, which does spiritual work. Avuka and Young Judea, two student organizations. Lectures about Zionism in the Land of Israel. Formally, F-O-R-M-A-L-L-Y, in a formal, official fashion. Formally, everything is lovely, elegant, and proper. But in fact, something is lacking. The historical consciousness that Jewish existence is connected with a renaissance of sanctity in the Land of Israel. Let me read that again. Something is lacking. What is lacking in the mind of the Mizrahi, in the Mizrahi movement, as understood by the chief rabbi, if you will, of American Mizrahi people? Rabbi Soloveitchik is that person. He is criticizing his own party. What exactly is lacking? Here's what's lacking, in his opinion. The historical consciousness that Jewish existence is connected with a renaissance of sanctity in the Land of Israel, and that such a renaissance is not only a right to which Jews are entitled, but a necessity, a conditio sine qua non of our existence, a condition without which there is like nothing. In other words, you got it. This has to be fulfilled. That's my understanding. I didn't look it up, but just looking at the Latin that I know, a conditio sine qua non, a condition that must be fulfilled, a necessity. That's what's missing here. That's what's missing here, he says, in the Mizrahi movement in 1945 in America. This is the sentiment that the halacha inculcated via the ultimatum, let him give up his life rather than sin. This is the sentiment that the halacha inculcated, that there's a sine qua non, that it's got to be this way. You've got to have a Land of Israel that's infused with holiness. And it's the Jewish person's right and obligation. It is a necessity. And without that internal driving force, there can be no militant Jewish politics. If I do not feel the burning need, and I myself am not convinced that the alternative is not an option, I can bang on the table all I want. But the British clerk in the colonial office will discern that my irritation is artificial, that in truth I'm not really all that upset. Where is American Jewry's militant energy and aggressiveness? Where do they hear the clear idea of the historical necessity and uniqueness of Jewish destiny such that they should demand its realization? In a word, v'hakarat ho'ahuveh. Where is their recognition of the present tense? He defined it earlier. V'hakarat ho'ahuveh. You know what I think? He's speaking in 1945. Rav Cook Sr. has already passed away. Passed away in 1931, 32 the latest. Who took over? His son. Rav Cook had a son. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook. We read his book as well. We read Rav Cook Sr. We read Rav Cook Jr. Rav Cook Sr. was a poet, and he was a philosopher, and he wrote in beautiful, flowery terms, and we enjoyed his book. And hopefully we'll see another one or two. But his son was just laying it out there, a real firebrand. His son was a real firebrand. Now, if you were with the Chabad Blue Ash people on Tisha B'Av night, mostly Tisha B'Av, if you will, and we saw this Israeli film in our hands, all about the paratroopers who took over East Jerusalem and defeated the Jordanians, who had absolutely like expunged Jews from the old city of Yerushalayim for the first time in centuries. And they were so happy to do it. Rabbi Cook Jr. of Tzvi Yehuda Cohen Cook gets up in 1967, sometime, celebration of the anniversary of the Medina, Yom Ha'atzma'ut, in 1967. Rav Cook Jr., Rav Tzvi Yehuda gets up in Yeshiva Merkaz Rav Cook, his father's yeshiva, big, beautiful place. You have to see it. It's gorgeous, beautiful, big building. Hundreds of guys learning over there. Gets up there, and it's recreated in a movie. A rabbi gets up and starts speaking. They're celebrating. People are dancing in the streets. They're happy. It's Yom Ha'atzma'ut. He says, but I wasn't happy on that day in 1948. Because they carved out from Israel, the very heart of Israel. He says, where is my Shechem? Where is my Yericho? Where is my Hebron? Where is my full Yerushalayim? Where is all that? I didn't get it. When they gave us Israel in 1948, we didn't get all this portion of land. They gave us other parts of Israel, but we didn't get the very heartland. Where is Shechem, where Joseph is buried? Where's Hebron, where the patriarchs are buried? Where's, I don't know what to call it, East Yerushalayim, but where is the old city of Yerushalayim? Where is all that? 3 months later, it was all in his hands. It was like God heard his plea and said, oh, of course. Oh, but of course, Rabbi. You'd like Shechem? You'd like Kiryat Arba? Hebron? A full Yerushalayim? No problem. I'll have some Jewish guys send that right into your lap in about 3 months. Can you hang in? What he was lamenting in 1967 about the 1948 partition of the land of Israel, 47, and then declared a state in 48. He was lamenting all that heartland that had belonged to Klal Yisrael thousands of years ago. Rabbi Cook wanted it all back. I'm not giving that to the Arabs. They don't deserve it. It's not their land. That's Jewish land. And I want it all back. Hashem says, okay. If you want it all back, then you'll get it all back. Because you dearly desire that. You want that. Rabbi Cook Jr. was expressing exactly, it seems to me, what Rabbi Soloveitchik is crying. It's lacking in American Mizrahi. Where's the guts? Where's the heart? Where's the soul? Where's the fire? Rabbi Cook says, I have that in spades, and I want all my land back. Hashem says, well then, you will get it back. An amazing thing. People were sitting there in 67 listening to him, and then 3 months later, the Six-Day War delivered all that right into his hands. And he didn't waste it. No, he didn't waste it. He then told his best students, I need you to develop a little settlement here, and you over there. And before you knew it, from 67 till the present day, Talmidei Rav Cook Jr. are creating a new reality in what's called the West Bank, to the great consternation of the Arab world and the United States and everybody who wants to see a two-state solution. Those Jews are not going to leave. Efrat is not getting destroyed anytime soon. They got rid of Gush Katif. Yeah, the Jews gave back to Gaza. What they get in place? A terrorist state. You give back to Gaza with your greenhouses and you give it all up and you make every single Jew get uprooted? Really? And you're hoping it's going to be peaceful? Really? You think Arabs are interested in peace? Of course not. I hate to say it, but many Arabs are not interested. Now, some are. Some are against the terrorists. They do want to live in peace and then leave them alone. They want to have a family and a job and live a life. Others just want to fight and fight and fight all day long. That's their way to get into heaven. They kill, they be killed. This is their mentality. Very difficult to overcome it. You have to put up as much of a force against the Arab jihadists. You have to put up an equal force. They're committed tooth and nail to the last man, willing to die. Jewish people have to be willing to live and make a life in the shtachim, in these settlements. No matter what Biden says about them, no matter what the ultra-left says, that's the Jewish way. That's Rav Cook's approach. And Rav Cook is like he was reading Rabbi Soloveitchik in a way. Not that he needed to. He was already a man on fire as it was. But he's delivering in Israel. That's where he was living. He was delivering the fire that everybody, Soloveitchik, is lamenting was absent in America in 1945 in the American Mizrahi Party. He writes, he continues, what Soloveitchik does. On the one hand, Jewish political status and dignity have greatly attenuated and cheapened. The world has never been so false as it is now. On the other hand, we lack the spiritual ammunition to shorten this period. And from the Slichos, he quotes, we are guiltier than every nation, more ashamed than every generation, says Rabbi Soloveitchik. I am not particularly afraid for the political future of the return to Zion. In that connection, I trust in the master of the universe, and I know the verses that Haman once heard from those three schoolboys. Hatch a plot. It shall be foiled. Agree on action. It shall not succeed. For with us is God. Isaiah 8. Utsu eitz of the sufar. Right? Chabad says this after every davening. Utsu eitz of the sufar. Dabru davar v'lo yakum. Utsu eitz of the sufar. It's a pasuk out of Isaiah. Hatch a plot. It'll be foiled. Agree on action. It won't succeed. For God is with us. Ki Manukel, because the Almighty is with us. I am, however, he says, concerned about an entirely different phenomenon, namely the spiritual atrophy that could befall the American Jewish masses vis-a-vis the return to Zion. They lack the fire, the ardor, the ecstatic enthusiasm that sustain a person through various crises and times of pain and suffering. By the way, have you ever had a tremendous desire for something? You want to accomplish a goal, and you felt nothing is going to stand in my way. Nothing. Nothing will defeat me. Nothing. I'm going to root for my cause. I'm going to advocate for my cause. I'm going to twist ears. I'm going to twist arms. I'm going to get a hold of people and convince them. I'm going to overcome their arguments and all their objections. I'm going to win, and they will lose. You have to have that kind of fight in you. You have to have that fire in your belly for something. Indeed, we were at Notre Dame University years ago, my wife and I, because I like graduations. Went to hear a graduation to see the Notre Dame graduation. Couldn't get in to the stadium. We didn't have tickets. But there are lots of people who just want to be on the campus on graduation day. And they made the Di Bartolo Recreation Center, Student Center, and maybe mini gym, they made that available to people who are visiting the campus. So you go into this nice auditorium, air conditioned, and you can watch the ceremony on the electronic link. You know, because the stadium is only 100 feet away. Why am I saying all this to you? Because two speakers spoke, and I remember one of them in particular. There may have been one in particular that I remember more than anything. There were two, a student and Charlie Sheen's father, Martin Sheen. Martin Sheen got the Laertes Award for Best Catholic of the Year. Well, believe it or not, he made a great speech, and I remember one thing from the speech, and I'll share it with you. Martin Sheen, the great actor, said, when you get up to heaven, God's going to say, all right now, roll up your sleeves and show us your scars. And the typical soul is going to say, scratch his head and say, roll up my sleeves. Show you our scars. Show you my scars. I don't have any scars. I don't have any scars. Am I supposed to have scars on my arms? I don't have any scars. And God's going to say, wow, what a pity. Wasn't there anything on earth worth fighting for? That so hit me hard. That completely was like a piece of, that was a 2x4 going right across the side of my head. Isn't there anything on earth worth fighting for? I mean, anything? Can't you find something that you can fight for? Going to go through life not fighting for a thing? Not standing up for something? I mean, nothing moves you? Will you be the guy with the tombstone? He was a Phillies fan? That's on his tombstone, I heard. Some guy. He was Tom Smith. He was a Phillies fan. My goodness. Well, he stood for the Phillies. He cared about baseball. Got to stand for something. Senator Soloveitchik, I am concerned about an entirely different phenomenon, namely the spiritual atrophy that could befall the American Jewish masses vis-a-vis the return to Zion. They lack the fire, the ardor, the ecstatic enthusiasm that sustain a person through various crises and times of pain and suffering. You have to overcome pain and suffering and keep on keeping on. I am more afraid, he says, of the United Jewish Front at the United Nations Conference on International Organization than of the firing squads. They have fed the Zionist masses a line about a successful campaign, many legends and silly remedies. I do not know whether the masses are ready to appear in Zion based on the pasuk, quote, when Babylon's 70 years are over, I will take note of you. Jeremiah 29. It seemed to him, Achashverosh, that the time was up because more than 70 years had passed since Yechoniah went into exile, when in fact he should have counted using the verse in Daniel, the number, quote, the number of years that were to be the term of Jerusalem's desolation, 70 years. See Daniel chapter 9. It all depends on how one calculates the end time. One could start counting from the time Yechoniah went into exile in Babylon, using an exilic, if you will, however you pronounce that word, exilic, secular calculus, made from the standpoint of social politics or national politics, employing the same formulas Babylon uses for its calendar and its history. If the land of Israel is simply a matter of secular aspirations and workaday worldviews, then Achashverosh and Jews also can miscalculate and conclude that the end time has come, and yet the Redeemer has not arrived, and all is false. However, if one starts counting from the time of Jerusalem's desolation using a sacred calculus made from the perspective of Jewish history and eternity, from the standpoint of the sanctification remaining in effect both at the time of Ezra and for all time, with the motto, not by might nor by power, with the faith that tomorrow shall be a festival of God, said Moses, Exodus 32, then that yields a completely different calculation and an entirely different worldview. Then one does not despair. One does not give up hope. Then from crisis emerges the vision of a lampstand all of gold. How do American Zionists compute? Using Babylon or Jerusalem as their starting point? What is the meaning of the verses, quote, Moses went out to his kinsfolk, and he witnessed their labors. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, and then he saw two Hebrews fighting. What's the meaning? What is the chazon ha'atid? It's the vision of the future. What is the sight of the bush was consumed? The bush was on fire. A bush all aflame. Yet the bush was not consumed. The chazon ha'atid, the future vision, consists in one word, Torah, Jewish thought, and the Jewish worldview. Rav Metzia 114a says as follows, Rabbi Bar Avua found Elijah standing in a cemetery of idolaters. Rabbi Bar Avua lived during the darkest period of Jewish settlement in Babylon, when the entire spiritual world of the Gentiles comprised a great big cemetery containing the graves of promises unfulfilled and ideas betrayed, the graves of uprightness and fairness. And probably, in parallel to these burial plots of spiritual values and philosophical ideals, there stretched endless fields filled with the mass graves of Jewish martyrs killed by a murderer, while the false world stood silently by. And Rabbi Bar Avua, despairing and despondent, trudged between the graves. Suddenly, he saw Elijah, the angel of redemption. Please, everybody, please mute yourself. Please, I'm so sorry. I have to ask you this. please mute yourselves because sounds are coming through and they are a little bit, just a little bit getting in the way of my head. Thank you so much. Shkoyach. Suddenly he saw Elijah, the angel of redemption, who carried tidings of redemption, a new prophecy, a new vision, new promises, standing on the heap of graves. Out of a state of crisis and tribulation emerged the figure of the Redeemer, of Elijah, of the Messiah. Rabbi Bar Avuha, who presumably could not understand the juxtaposition of an angel of redemption with a great big Jewish cemetery, asked him, "Is my master not a Kohen?" We have a tradition, of course, that Elijah is a Kohen, that is to say, someone who is fearful of the dead, of critical moments, troubles, cataclysmic events, calamities, and graves. What a fascinating way to categorize Kohanim. I would have thought that he would have said, Kohanim are our leaders, our Torah teachers, our fearless ones, and so on. He could have gone that route, because the Torah describes Kohanim like that. In the future, you'll go to the Kohanim Alevim, and they'll teach the Torah to you. He could have gone that way. But instead, he's understanding Kohanim. People are fearful of the dead, fearful of critical moments, troubles, cataclysmic events, calamities, and graves. Redemption can only come about through peace. Elijah is, of course, the angel of peace. Through success and joyous times. Death and annihilation, by contrast, drive away the Kohen. Says in Leviticus 21, he shall not go in where there is any dead body. He shall not defile himself, even for his father or mother. Here, though, father was incinerated in Majdanek. Mother died in Buchenwald. Brother contracted typhus in Theresienstadt. How can we speak of redemption? You may not enter such a space. There is a prohibition against defiling yourself to the dead. To this, Elijah responded, "The graves of idolaters do not impart ritual impurity. These graves exist on our account. We suffered, but we're not the guilty ones. Everyone other than the Jews is guilty. And because things are bad, the situation is critical, the waters have reached my neck." A pasuk in Tehillim, Psalm 69. "It is difficult to endure the suffering. Out of this crisis do I emerge. When the title Adam, man, itself, cannot be applied to many of our enemies." It says, "You are called Adam. Atam kruyim Adam. Vehem enam kruyim Adam. You, Israel, you're called Adam, man. But idolaters are not called man." Ah, then the Messiah must arrive. But Elijah taught him another law. From where do we know that a naked person may not separate truma? As it is written, Deuteronomy 23, "Let him not find anything unseemly among you and turn away from you." If a people has lost its cultural clothing, its spiritual values, its historical perspective, its connection with the past, its ideals and mitzvahs, it cannot separate truma toward the work of redemption. It cannot contribute to the process of redemption. It cannot be a torem, a donor, to the building of the land and the nation. In order to persevere past and push through disappointments, one needs historical clothing and spiritual eternity ideals. Without them, the graves of idolaters impart ritual impurity. If there is, quote, anything unseemly, the Almighty God is absent. He turns away from you. And if he's absent, a grave becomes dangerous. And what is the historical clothing of the Knesset Yisrael, of the Jewish people? It's not the full spectrum of the Torah. Says Job, its measure is longer than the earth and broader than the sea. Job 11. But when I say Torah, I don't mean it as an empty term. I do not mean it as an empty term. I refer to a program, a concrete political course. You may laugh at me, But I believe that if certain politicians would have had a more Torah-true approach, a deeper Torah understanding, a more intimate relationship with the Jewish tradition and worldview, their efforts would have met with more success. Gentiles would have respected them more and taken their demands more seriously. I always say, a Gentile need not like a Jew, but he must respect them. And he is more likely to do so if he discerns something authentic and singular about that Jew. But I wish to speak here of the Mizrahi as a Torah movement, for otherwise, neither Mizrahi nor any other Jewish movement has a future. Ignorance destroys not only traditional positive Judaism, but even Jewish heresy and rebellious sinfulness. Soon we will have neither Talmudists nor rebellious sinners, and the loss of both upsets me. With respect to Torah scholars, you understand. Without them, a Jewish world is completely inconceivable to me. But I would want rebellious sinners as well, because they demonstrate best that Judaism is alive and that there is a being against whom to rebel. I think highly of the wise son as well as the wicked son. I'm always afraid of the simple son. In general, one must fear a stupid person. And I'm fearful of the son who does not know how to ask. Both the wise son and the wicked son can build the land of Israel. The simple son and the son who doesn't know how to ask, however, will not succeed in doing so. But clearing away ignorance is not easy. It's a long, painstaking, difficult road, full of obstacles and pitfalls. I spoke about this at the Mizrahi Convention in Atlantic City. See the previous chapter. If the Mizrahi National Education Committee follows the guidelines and builds schools for small school children, then the verse, they who sow in tears shall reap with songs of joy. Hazorim bedima, barina yiktzoru. Those who sow in tears will reap in joy. Psalm 126. If they do that and they build schools for children, they will, then the verse will, please God, apply to us. If, however, the Mizrahi imitates other parties that fulfill their sense of obligation with campaigns and banquets, then I pity the movement to return to Zion in general and the religious renaissance in particular. I don't wish either to praise or to critique. I heard Mr. Abraham Cohen's report. It's no more than a start. What comes next depends on the leaders of the Mizrahi movement. Asmodeus might yet laugh at us. Ashmedai, like he's a devil, he's a demon. He might yet laugh at us, heaven forbid, just as he laughed at the man who ordered boots that would last him 7 years, but whose life was cut short. See Gittin 68b. This evening, though, I would just like to point out two factors that are important to highlight before we throw ourselves into the work of Torah education. The first is a fact, while the second must be considered a concern, an obligation. Factor number one, we Jews living in the diaspora have a dual issue regarding our religion. First, we face the general problem of a religious worldview relating to its secular, utilitarian, pragmatic, Epicurean surroundings. Do not think that the Christian churches of Catholicism and Protestantism don't have their own problems, struggles, and conflicts. If you would read their literature and hear their laments sometime, you might think that they were members of the OU, of the Union of Orthodox Rabbis, or the RCA. Our Torah, which leads man to the master of the universe, also comes into conflict with a cheap, materialistic vision. Second, we Jews face a special problem when it comes to our relationship with the nations of the world. We live in a Gentile environment, in a spiritually heterogeneous and diametrically opposed setting. We have no Torah air to breathe. The whole tragedy of the exile, even when we are politically free, inheres in this problem. The second issue, though not the first, can be solved in the land of Israel. Anyone familiar with religious literature nowadays knows that romantic feelings, yearnings, and sentiments for a religious rebirth have been awakened within certain Gentile, not Jewish, cultural spheres. Today, the better man seeks God because the gods he had served had deceived and betrayed him. bringing a deluge to the world. Started talking about atheists or humanists. They used to have faith in humanity. After the Holocaust, they used to have faith in humanity. Today, the better man seeks God because the gods he had served deceived and betrayed him, bringing a deluge to the world. Contemporary civilized men are not satisfied with a coarse, materialistic approach. Instead, looking for something loftier and sublimer. They have come to the realization that without, quote, knowing what is above you, man is a wild animal. Organized churches take advantage of this. In particular, the Catholic Church, which is especially attractive to the modern God seeker on account of its mysteriousness, its irrationalism, and authoritative character. It distinguishes itself in this regard. It is interesting that the modern romantic searches not for a rationalistic religion, but specifically for a faith marked by its absolutely transcendent characteristics and totalitarian features. In many cases, the Catholic Church acquires new members from the most radical Protestant denomination, the Unitarians. By the way, they're falling apart too. I mean, completely and utterly. The Catholic Church is not even a thing anymore, really, in many respects, in the United States. And that's partly because of Vatican II. What is the actual situation with us, with our youth, official Orthodox communal activists, who, despite having lived in America for decades, absolutely do not understand the American Jew? They place Jewish youth into two categories, a yeshiva youth, which debates the finer points of passages in the Ketos HaChoshen, and a reckless youth focused only on good times. It is true that there is a youth whose numbers are large, that has absolutely no connection with the Jewish people, no historical consciousness, and no sense of responsibility. But there is also a real, sincere, earnest, mostly academic youth. While its members are very distant from Judaism, and some of them relate with scorn to the crippled religion to which they were exposed in the houses of their ignorant parents, they are seeking, if not Judaism, then at least God. Unfortunately, the young American rabbinate, even the Orthodox rabbinate, is not large enough to grasp its task and grab the bull by the horns. The reason is simply that these rabbis don't stand culturally on a higher level than these searching young men and women. And sometimes they stand far lower. A young academic said to me about a certain prominent non-Orthodox clergyman who considers himself to be a great philosopher and preaches and sermonizes to sticks and stones about Judaism, religion, and ethics. Quote, I don't know whether this clergyman has any inkling of the most elementary principles of classical or modern religious philosophy. Whom is he fooling? End quote. I myself just had the opportunity not long ago to deliver a popular philosophical lecture to a particular group that included some Jewish students. They were so eager to hear a new perspective that they peppered me with questions until midnight. What do I think about the Jewish conception of divinity, the messianic idea, creation, evolution, the return to Zion, a Jewish state? What does Allah have to say about social justice, labor rights, and so on and so forth? And this comprises a large proportion of the academic Jewish youth, which will later exert significant influence on American Jewish life. Who thinks about these matters and makes the effort? The dry sermons of our non-Orthodox clergymen cannot satisfy the seeking spirit. If young people do not find what they're looking for with us, they will look for it elsewhere. In short, there is today in certain circles a desire for a religious worldview. The Jewish religion, as crippled by the Judaism of the temples, cannot compete with the Christian churches, with the colorful Catholic faith. And there lurks the threat of apostasy. It will come years from now, but it will come. A couple of cliches about Jewish ethics and Judaism cannot outdo the entire religious Weltanschauung offered by the churches. Who thinks about these matters? Who attempts to solve this problem? Yes, there is such a group, the Reconstructionists, who wish to ensnare the searching souls. And one has to admit that they have succeeded up to a point. The reason they have not achieved more is not, heaven forbid, because Orthodoxy has met them on the ideological battlefield, but simply because they propagate philosophical follies and are exceedingly superficial. Some make a fuss about the Reconstructionist sitter, which is truly an awful thing. But have we done anything to conquer it, to counter it, rather? Have we done anything to counter that sinner? Calling someone a heretic does not win the battle. In the 17th century, the rabbinic court of Amsterdam lost its struggle against Spinoza because it thought that a person's worldview could be eliminated via the promulgation of bans. Have we formulated anything philosophical? Have we developed an ideology that would be accessible to a modern man who wishes to find content in his spiritual life? Is there even one journal that has an ideological character? We will not build up Judaism with sermons and banquets. When I suggested that the Mizrahi publish such a journal, good Jews who consider themselves Mizrahi members but whose evil inclinations and ulterior motives are still stronger than their ideals scuttled the proposition. Believe me, if the Mizrahi could formulate something of a philosophical Torah ideology, it would acquire powers tantamount to the addition of many more members. Without spiritual gusto and culturally dominating ethos, without spiritual gusto and a culturally dominating ethos, the party cannot grow. The president is not to blame. Protest the sitter, but make sure to edit a new sitter based on the Torah of Moses. The Mizrahi must be able to reach not only the Jew of the Beit Midrash, but also the cultural Jew. Factor number two, and with this we conclude, I saw the program of the Mizrahi National Council Conference, and I noticed that education plays a large role in it. Furthermore, the banquet is devoted to education. Very nice. However, I wish to draw attention here to one thing that one must know before one engages in Torah work. Torah work, I mean simply yeshivos, chadorim, the ABCs, chumash, gemara, the foundations of Judaism, can only spread in our country if one principle is kept in mind, either Torah or bust. And with that, we'll let you go, my dear friends. Thank you so much. We've just concluded his lecture on recognition of the present and vision for the future. Very powerful stuff. God willing, meet us next week for And a Man Wrestled with Him Until the Break of Dawn, delivered in May 1946. Thank you so much, everybody. A big Yishter Kayach to all. Thank you so much, and God willing, we'll catch you on next week for more book club. We'll continue on page 81. And for those of you in our Tanakh class, see you tomorrow night as we mop up chapter 19 and go into chapter 20, God willing. Take care, and people have a great, safe day. All the best. Thanks for calling in. Bye-bye now.